It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. Broadcasting on 100.1 FM, we are your public radio station here in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is fair, 64 degrees and breezy. They have steady west winds at 20 miles per hour, gusting to 24 out at the airport right now. 54% humidity and 10 miles of visibility. Mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day. We've already hit our high of 65, at least here on Burrow Hill. West winds will continue today, tonight, and tomorrow, somewhere around 15 to 20 miles per hour, gusting every once in a while. Mostly clear skies overnight with a low around 54. Mostly sunny tomorrow with a high near 68. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Tustamina is expected to come back into service today. Glacier Bay National Park and Reserve has started its own cruise ship monitoring program. And a big ship is laying fiber between Unalaska and Kodiak.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In a display of pro-democracy solidarity, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is resisting China's threats of retaliation by moving ahead with a visit to Taiwan. The Biden administration's urged China not to turn Pelosi's trip into a crisis, but Beijing has warned that a U.S. visit could fuel pro-independence sentiment in Taiwan, an island located just 100 miles off the coast of southeastern China. NPR's John Ruwitch has more.
Pelosi's plane touched down late on Tuesday night, local time. She's the most senior elected U.S. official to visit the island in 25 years. The visit comes at a time of already strained relations between Washington and Beijing, and less than a week after President Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping talked on the phone. During that call, she told Biden that with regard to Taiwan, those who play with fire will eventually get burned. Beijing considers the self-governed island a part of China, and she hopes to unify it with the mainland by force if necessary. A source familiar with Pelosi's schedule says she's expected to meet members of Taiwan's legislature and President Tsai Ing-wen on Wednesday. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Beijing.
1 year after sweeping back into power in Afghanistan, the Taliban are under greater international scrutiny since a U.S. strike made public last night killed al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. One of the key planners of the 9/11 terror attacks was targeted on a balcony of a safe house in downtown Kabul. Former CIA Director David Petraeus describes what it indicates about the Taliban.
The fact that the Taliban regime is not just tolerating but hosting the leader of al-Qaeda and the most important al-Qaeda leader other than Osama bin Laden is very, very significant. Moreover, there's a real worry that the Islamic State is actually the more active extremist element in Afghanistan, taking advantage of the situation in the wake of the toppling of the government.
Zawahiri became the head of al-Qaeda after his predecessor, Osama bin Laden, was killed in a U.S. strike in 2011. The Justice Department is suing Idaho over that state's near-total abortion ban. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports it's the first public step from a Biden administration task force designed to protect reproductive freedom.
Attorney General Merrick Garland says the Idaho legislation set to take effect August 25th directly conflicts with federal law and the U.S. Constitution. Garland says hospitals that receive Medicare funding must provide stabilizing treatment to pregnant women who suffer medical emergencies. The Justice Department says Idaho's law chills providers' willingness to perform abortions and blocks access to medically necessary health care. DOJ is seeking an injunction against the state law. A task force led by Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta is following developments in other jurisdictions and evaluating possible legal action. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The Alaska State Ferry Tustamina is expected to resume service today after pausing its schedule last month due to critical staffing issues. KMXT's Dylan Simard has this report.
The MV Tustamina had been in service for less than 2 weeks when it docked in Homer on July 26th. According to an Alaska Department of Transportation press release, the Alaska Marine Highway System ferry had operated with more or less the same crew since it started its 2022 schedule earlier that month. Kodiak Republican House Speaker Louise Stutes says that there were not enough replacement crew available to operate the ferry.
Certainly, like everybody else, they're feeling an employee pinch. But in my conversations with the commissioner of DOT, he actually had said to me that they were going to be able to staff up the Tustamina. But the problem is COVID.
The Tustamina is presently slated to resume regular service August 2nd, departing from Homer and bound for ports around southwest Alaska. The Alaska Marine Highway System has been struggling to hire new staff this year, even with $5,000 hiring bonuses. Stute says that irregular service makes it harder to attract candidates.
When you don't know if you're going to be working from week to week and you have a family to feed, it makes it pretty tough.
The Tustamina entered a refit and maintenance period last December to extend its nearly 60-year service life even further. The Alaska Department of Transportation is planning to replace the ferry in 2027. Stute says that the Department of Transportation commissioner has told her that the staffing shortage shouldn't result in further cancellations for ferries this season. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard.
A ship departed Unalaska last week to begin laying 800 miles of subsea fiber all the way to Kodiak. KUCB's Laurelyn Cruz has more from Unalaska.
It's a foggy morning on the northeast corner of Mackinac Island. This is the starting point for 800 miles of subsea fiber that will soon bring high-speed internet to the Aleutians. Just offshore, the CSIT Intrepid, a 377-foot cable-laying ship, has started the job. John Burnett is the construction manager for the project in Unalaska. He explains how a crew of divers is dropping the cable down into the water near the shore.
There's buoys that are suspending the fiber just above the ocean floor. And then once they have it all the way in, which they do all the way to the land right now, then they're going to go through and they're cutting those buoys off. That's going to allow that cable to come down.
This is a milestone for Alaska internet provider GCI and its AU Aleutians fiber project, which is on track to bring high-speed internet to Unalaska and Accutan by the end of this year. But getting that cable down to the right spot on the ocean floor is just one of many challenges. Jeff Dunlop is the captain of the IT Intrepid.
Planning a cable route is much like a railroad or a goat trail. You take the path of least risk and least resistance. Yeah. Cables don't like going over things. They want to follow a contour.
To find the best possible route, engineers surveyed the geology and marine habitat of the ocean floor. They also met with local fishermen to make sure the cable isn't in a spot where it could get dug up by trawlers. Once the route was established, the cable had to be specifically engineered to fit the conditions of where it will sit on the ocean floor. The IT Intrepid typically lays cable at a speed of about 1 to 2.5 miles per hour. While en route to Larsen Bay on Kodiak, the ship will stop in Accutan, Sandpoint, King Cove, and Chignik Bay. It's expected to complete its voyage by early fall. Dunlop says bringing internet to these remote communities is part of a bigger picture, creating infrastructure for the globe.
The reality is that there's literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of kilometers of cable on the bottom laid by people like ourselves. It's not just a local event where small islands are being interconnected. It's the global network.
If all goes according to plan, Unalaska and Accutan will see high-speed internet by the end of this year. Service to Sandpoint and King Cove will follow by the end of 2023, and Chignik Bay and Larsen Bay in late 2024. In Unalaska, I'm Laurelyn Cruz.
A former state ferry laid up in Ketchikan has some new residents, refugees from the war in Ukraine. KRBD's Eric Stone went on board to meet some of them and has this report.
Before Russia invaded Ukraine, 29-year-old Mikita Zakharchenko spent half a decade working on ships.
I worked in Europe. It's Mediterranean Sea, North Sea, England also. Yeah, we work in the big container ships.
Now he's spending his days on another ship, the MV Malaspina. The former Alaska Marine Highway mainliner is undergoing a transformation. It was purchased earlier this year by the owners of The Mill at Ward Cove. That's a private cruise ship terminal operating out of Ketchikan's old pulp mill. Zakharchenko and three other refugees are working to turn the Malaspina into a museum and maritime training center and housing for the cruise terminal's seasonal employees. Zakharchenko says when he first arrived in early June, the former ferry was showing its age.
Before, it looks like it's nobody lived for 3 years here. It's looking, it's not so bad, but we need to organize everything. It was dirty, too much dust, feel not so fresh air inside. We cleaning, removed everything, some lights is not working, don't work in the toilets, pipes, something, now everything is okay, we're trying to make it better,
Now the lights are on, the water is running, and 16 people are living aboard, including the four refugees and a dozen employees of the cruise terminal. By day, Zakharchenko works on restoring the boat. In the evenings, you're likely to find him at the Malaspina's bar, playing foosball, watching TV, or enjoying a home-cooked meal with the shipmates. He comes to Ketchikan from the Ukrainian port city of Mariupol. He says the city had grown tense since Russia's annexation of nearby Crimea in 2014. Then this spring, tanks and troops started pouring over Ukraine's borders with Russia and Belarus. He says he knew it wouldn't be long before the fighting arrived at his doorstep.
It started from the 24th of February. We think it's full-out war, and we need to find some safe place.
He fled to the western part of the country and started volunteering. He stayed in Ukraine for another 2 weeks before he was granted permission to leave for Germany in mid-March. But his parents remained in Mariupol as the Russian army laid siege to the city.
We don't have any communication, and we didn't call. We check the news, special news. We see Mariupol is almost destroyed, and we don't know what happened with my family. We so really worry.
For 2 weeks, he was left to wonder whether his parents were alive or dead as his hometown crumbled under relentless Russian artillery fire. And then
I received a call from my father, and my father first what he said, we are still alive. It was really, I'm crying, because I'm happy and I'm crying.
They had escaped Mariupol, taking 3 days to reach central Ukraine on roads riddled with landmines. Today, Zakharchenko says they're safe in Germany. Meanwhile, Zakharchenko and his high school sweetheart and partner of 13 years made their way to Anchorage through the Uniting for Ukraine program. That's a program that allows Ukrainian refugees to stay in America for up to 2 years if they have a sponsor. That's when longtime Alaska tourism businessman John Binkley says he got a call from his son, who was working with volunteers in Anchorage to find places to resettle refugees fleeing the war.
And we said, bring them to Ketchikan. We've got the perfect spot for them here. We'll take care of them. And we have the perfect situation, the MV Malaspina, that can take care of them as well.
They arrived in early June. Binkley says he's not paying the refugees. He says he's not allowed to until they're issued a social security number. But he's covering all their expenses. They have an account at the local supermarket, access to a car, and the use of numerous toys at the cruise terminal, like kayaks, e-bikes, and sea cycles.
And they've been phenomenal. People, just wonderful human beings, hardworking. They have purpose here now, and we've just come to love them and appreciate them, and we feel humbled to help in some small way.
16-year-old Sofia Zagrabelska is living aboard the Malaspina with her mother. It's the second time the pair has uprooted their lives fleeing the war. They had lived near the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk until war broke out with Russian-backed separatists in 2014. They fled to Kharkiv. But then they were forced to relocate again this spring when Russian troops started bombing and shelling their new home. Zagrabelska is a little self-conscious about her English, but she works up the courage to tell me that she's just glad to be away from the fighting.
I'm very happy to be in USA because in USA I be in safe zone. I'm very happy I don't listen sound bomb. And I sleep in bed, not in, under floor.
As for Zakharchenko, he says he's still getting used to the rain here in Ketchikan, but he loves the scenery.
Oh, it's a very beautiful place. I never see it before. The view like here, it's amazing looking.
He says if the government allows it, he could see himself staying in Ketchikan for quite a while.
Oh, for 10 years, maybe, I don't know. Everything is going good. I like this place. I like people who around me who support me. I find new friends here. Also, my work is very interesting. I'm every day study something new.
He's glad to be safe, but at the same time, he yearns for home. He says he wishes he could turn back the clock to before the war and live his life in the country he loves.
I did not want to go away from Ukraine. It was my land, yeah. Everybody understands this, yeah.
But for now, a berth on the Malaspina will have to do. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve started its own cruise ship monitoring program this July. Cruise companies are paying for independent inspectors to board ships unannounced and make sure they follow environmental rules. Claire Strempel reports for KTOO.
Glacier Bay used to rely on the state's Ocean Ranger program for these inspections, but the program was defunded before the pandemic.
We were really hopeful that the Ocean Ranger program would continue.
Park scientist Scott Gendy said the Ocean Rangers were essential to the park's tourism structure.
We would not have an inspection program if the Ocean Ranger program didn't exist.
Ocean Rangers made sure the large cruise ships followed environmental rules, especially around the kind of wastewater they can discharge into Alaska waters. It was started by voters and paid for it through a statewide tax on cruise ship passengers. Governor Mike Dunleavy defunded the program in 2019. It's still on the books, but it hasn't been in the budget since. That puts the park and the cruise companies in a tight spot because they signed a decade-long contract that legally commits them to inspections. Park Superintendent Philip Hoogie says that those contracts mean the park has some of the highest environmental standards in the world.
We work tightly in partnership, a really good relationship with the cruise industry, but we also need to have independent verification on all aspects of our contract.
The park covers 3.3 million acres, and it's considered one of the gems of Southeast Alaska. Coastal temperate rainforest is punctuated by deep glacier-carved fjords and snow-covered peaks. About 600,000 people visit the park by cruise ship each year. The National Park Service's duty is to protect these resources while still making them available to the American public. The state still does port inspections on cruise ships, but Gendy says they don't go far enough. The park needs inspectors that are on the ships while they're at sail and who arrive unannounced for random inspections. Gendy says he hopes the independent contractor is a temporary solution.
We'd be thrilled to death if the state would integrate that into their Ocean Ranger program and we can get some Ocean Rangers back on board. But until then, this is our approach, and we're going to continue forward with these third-party inspectors.
So far, three major cruise lines have signed a contract with third-party inspectors. The park expects a contract with the fourth large cruise company soon. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
Governor Mike Dunleavy signed a package of public safety-related bills into law last week, including a measure that updates Alaska's definition of sexual assault, according to a report from the Alaska Beacon. The change had been sought for years by victims' advocates and allows the state to prosecute someone for sexual assault even if the victim freezes and doesn't verbally say no. Pre-existing law said only that an assault took place without consent if someone was threatened by force. Victim advocate Lisa Alana of Nome said the change was long overdue and, quote, one of the most important steps the state of Alaska has taken, close quote, to protect victims. Other parts of House Bill 325 expand the definition of domestic abuse to cover situations where an abuser involuntarily shares an explicit picture of a victim. Thursday's signing ceremony took place at the State Crime Lab in Anchorage, where Dunleavy also signed two other bills into law. Early and absentee in-person voting are open for Alaska's August 16th elections. Voting for both the regular primary election and special general election will be on the same ballot. In the Pick 1 primary election, voters will choose their top pick for U.S. Senator, U.S. Representative, Governor, State Senator, and State Representative. The top four vote-getters in each race will go on to the November general election ballot. On the back of the ballot, you will see a ranked choice voting for the special election to decide who will fill the rest of the term left by the late Representative Don Young. Voters will rank three candidates, Republicans Sarah Palin and Nick Begich, and Democrat Mary Peltola, who were determined by a pick-one primary in May. Absentee in-person voting, which allows voters to cast ballots early in a number of smaller Alaska communities, is available at the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly Chamber from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., Monday through Friday, through August 15th. For more information about the elections, or to find your polling place, or see a sample ballot, go to elections.alaska.gov. Voters can also call the Alaska Division of Elections office at 907-465-3021. The dates for Kodiak's fisheries debates have been set. Kodiak's Chamber of Commerce will host Alaska's gubernatorial candidates on October 3rd and U.S. congressional candidates October 4th. The debates will be held in person and streamed via Zoom and Facebook Live and broadcast here on KMXT.